Genesis chapter 32. How many of you would like to be able to change history? I think most of us probably have something in our past that we'd like to be able to change. Something that maybe we would have handled differently, or maybe we don't wish we'd have handled things differently, but we just wish that problem would go away. As we come into Genesis chapter 32, leaving chapter 31, do you think that thought crossed Jacob's mind? Boy, I wish I could escape my past. He had run away from home, basically. Yes, his parents gave him the direction to do it, but he had run away from home. He had found refuge with Laban. He had found a job. He had found two wives. He had found success with the blessings from God. But now it was time for him to go. It was time for him to turn around and go back home. And he was ready to go, wasn't he? He wasn't on good terms with his father-in-law at this point. So he was escaping what he felt would be danger. But what was he running toward? He was running toward his past. He was running toward what he presumed to be danger. We can't change history. We may try to escape things from our past, but, you know, very rarely do we escape the consequences of the things that we've done. And so Jacob was now having to go back and deal with the consequences of tricking his father and undermining his brother. And so as we look at Jacob, and we consider his actions and his reactions through this really time of crisis in his life, we see several things, several attitudes, several conflicts that perhaps we face when we find ourselves going through times of crisis. Maybe it's the conflict between faith and fear. What's going to win out? Is it going to be your faith or is it going to be your fear? Well, we're sitting in a church building, so what's our answer going to be? Our faith wins every time, right? I don't know. I think if we're honest with ourselves, sometimes we let fear control us rather than our faith. We see the conflict between trusting in God and scheming a plan for ourselves. Again, we'd want to say we always, always trust in God. But sometimes, if I'm honest, and I try to be, I will come up with something on my own. We see the conflict between asking God for help and then acting like we don't even know who God is. I know none of us are like that usually, but surely we know somebody. But chances are it's someone in our own home who reacts that way sometimes. It's someone in our own self. But as we enter into chapter 32, we see this continuing narrative of the life of Jacob. Now he's fleeing his father-in-law, having received once again the promise from God, but he's not looking forward to the family reunion. Somebody read for us verses 1 through 8 of Genesis 32.
Jacob also went on his way, and the angel of God met him. When Jacob saw him, he said, "This is the camp of God, so name that place Haman." Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed him, "This is what you are to say to my brother Esau. Your servant Jacob says, 'I've been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants. And I am sending this message to my Lord that I may find favor in your eyes. When the messenger returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and the herds, and camels as well. He thought, if Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that is left may escape.
So Jacob had a good idea, didn't he? Anticipating an unfriendly reunion, what did he do? Well, that was something he did, but I don't know that that was a wise thing that he did. What was something wise that he did? Sending those people, right? Sending them ahead to let Esau know Jacob's coming. Jacob is coming. And so he sends them ahead, but he sends them with a message. And the message is, "You're my Lord. I'm your servant. And I'm rich." Right? That's the essence of the message. Was that true? Part of it was, he was rich. But who was the Lord? Who was the servant in this relationship, according to God? Esau was the servant. And Jacob was to be the master. That was what God had said even before they were born, correct? So what's Jacob trying to do? You think?
Do you think he's trying to humble himself in order to be, you know, to bring it down a notch? Because when he left, he was acting like he got the blessing. You know, he stole it, basically, mm-hmm. even though God meant him to have it. So, I don't know. I thought he was just doing the humble myself and take the sting out of it.
Okay. We can give him the benefit of the doubt, right? Jacob, the schemer and the deceiver, finally is trying to humble himself. Perhaps that's it. Is there another option? Scared. That seems to be a repeating reaction from Jacob, isn't it? As he deals with these various conflicts in his life, is to do whatever he can to soften the blow, to smooth things over, not necessarily out of humility, maybe, hopefully, that'd be nice, but more so out of fear, Casey.
In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people into two groups.
He was greatly concerned about this meeting. When he left, what was Esau going to do? What was Esau planning to do before Jacob left? Kill him.
Well, and you know, whether he was doing this out of fear or if he was honestly doing this, you know, from a point of humility and, you know, trying to make right, it's biblical advice. You know, when someone's upset with you, you go to them and you discuss it before they haul you into court or do whatever else. You know, and whatever his motives were, he's trying to bring the volume in the room down just a little bit before he gets pounded on.
Okay.
God.
Leora first, then Mark.
Okay, God told him to go, so he needed to go. And yeah, he was afraid, but he still needed to go because God told him to go.
God said go. God said, "I will be with you."
That's right. He said,
"But
I will
be still
with you."
Had fear.
Right.
That's an example of fear winning out over faith.
But he was still going.
Sure, he was going.
I think that fear came, too, out of uncertainty of how he was going to be receptive. And that's why he sent the first party with the message, and that's why he then divided his folks up and said, well, if they slaughter them, we'll run, and stayed behind.
If those messengers had come back and said, Esau, we found him, and he's coming your way, and he's by himself, there may not have been quite the response that Jacob had. But 400 coming with him, it would be very intimidating. But Jacob had something that Esau didn't have. Back up in verse 1. Who did Jacob have in his company? Who did Jacob have on his side? The angels of God. He had protection. Had he seen angels of God before? He had. Back in chapter 28, when he was at Bethel, and he saw that vision of the angels ascending and descending the ladder. And so he was no stranger to being in the company of angels. Was there reason for him to be afraid?
On a human level, he was very afraid, mm-hmm. but he kept remembering God was with him, then on the spiritual level, he should not be afraid.
Okay. All right. He was afraid because he's like us, right? Jacob winds up being a hero of faith. He winds up, he is in the line of Christ. But he's just like you and me. He's just a human. He had no real special abilities. He was just blessed by God. Raise your hand tonight if you're not blessed by God. Okay. Good answer. God promised his protection. God provided protection for them.
One of the things that is probably eating on him is because whenever he left home, he left under a death threat.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it came from old Esau.
Right. Mm-hmm. And something like that, stealing the birthright, stealing the greater inheritance, stealing that blessing, that's something to be hard to forgive. Certainly near impossible to forget. But with this report, even with the angels on his side, with this report of Esau coming and 400 men with him, Jacob lives up to his name, and he begins to scheme. He begins to come up with his own plot, his own plans, and he jumped to a conclusion. Esau's coming to kill me. And that's not an unreasonable conclusion for him to draw. Now, we know, because we can read ahead. He couldn't see ahead, but we can read ahead. We know that he jumped to the wrong conclusion. But in his time, in his mind, that was the only way out. What will a guilty conscience do to you? It will make you afraid. It will make you near paranoid. If you're doing right, what do you have to fear? But if you're sneaking around, doing wrong, or having done someone wrong, you got a lot to fear, don't you? You got fear of being caught, fear of being found out. And so he's living with this guilt. He's been living with this guilt for a lot of years. And the only reasonable conclusion he can draw is my brother is coming to kill me. So how do you get rid of that? I'm not talking about Jacob now. I'm talking about you and me. How do we get rid of that feeling? If we're afraid someone's out to get us, how do you get rid of it? Okay. If there is a legitimate reason that someone you think someone might have something against you, you've got to get that out in the open with them. And you've got to clear the air. You've got to make things right. And ultimately, that's what we see happens in this narrative in the Bible. That's what happens between Jacob and Esau. But when we're living it, it's so hard to do. But hopefully, as we look at some of these Old Testament accounts, we can take some lessons that can apply to our lives. And I certainly think that that's one of them. Is we if we feel like someone's got a reason to be out to get us, and they may not know anything about it. I think sometimes we can be pretty good at keeping our secrets. But if our conscience is weighing on us and we're living miserably because of this fear that someone's going to find this out, we got to stop, right? And we got to make things right.
Because I've been trying to train myself to do that. And I have to say that the older I get, easier has become, but it doesn't mean that it lessens the need or the frequency of it. But when you find out how freeing it is to humble yourself and confess it and get right with somebody, it feels wonderful. It releases all those horrible emotions and feelings that happen as a result of conflict with someone.
Sin is a heavy burden, isn't it? And what did Jesus say about his yoke? My yoke is easy. My burden is light. We've got to unload that weight of sin. And that feeling of guilt will go away. Sin piles up. And it just gets heavier and heavier. And it's a crushing weight. And sometimes we need help to take care of that weight, to get back up. That's why we have the church, right? So that we can lean on each other, we can help one another up, we can help get those things out of each other's lives and move forward and have that joy and that light burden of Christ. Fear or faith? When fear takes over and faith takes the back seat, we're relying solely on ourselves. And if we trust in ourselves, we're always going to be disappointed. God is our rock. Our trust is to be in Him. Jacob had every advantage here. He had the blessings of God. He had the promise of God. He had the angels of God. And he was still afraid. Today, we have the blessings of God. We have the promise of God. We have the Spirit of God. What should we fear? You're right. Nothing. Absolutely nothing should we fear. But it's hard. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. Somebody coming in the fear would strike us. And I don't know anybody who could say that they wouldn't be fearful, but we shouldn't be, because if he takes our lives, the next moment we'll be in with the Lord.
That's right. But it's hard to think about things that way.
It's a huge concept.
Mm-hmm. So Jacob has this plan. We're going to divide in two. We're going to split up the camp. Now, notice he's left the angels out of the picture, right? He's splitting up his camp of people. He already had two camps, the camp of his family and the camp of angels. But now he's making his own two camps. He's relying on his own ideas. And his idea is, if one of the camps is attacked, then the others can escape. That's real thoughtful, right? It's not a good strategy against 400 men. And had he kept his trust in God and stayed with those original two camps, the one he had and the one God provided for him, he would have been better off. Now, things worked out, we know, as we read on.
He wasn't nearly as powerful as the four kings together that Abraham defeated in chapter 14, mm-hmm, with 318 men.
Right. That's right. But Jacob did do another thing right. He prayed.
Verse 9, he prayed.
That's right. He prayed. Casey, you're right. Your microphone's right beside you. Can you read verses 9 through 12?
Then Jacob prayed, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, you said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two groups. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I'm afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. Is that as far as you want to go?
Yep. Every line in that prayer makes it evident that Jacob was fully aware of the nature of God and the power of God and the promises of God. But he was still motivated by fear. Now I think about the father of that demonic child in Mark chapter 9, who cried out, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Jacob believed, but he wasn't all in yet. But in this prayer, he did. He humbled himself. He makes his case to God as to why God ought to deliver him from the hand of Esau. He reminds God of his covenant with him. It was on the basis of that covenant that Jacob asked God for this help. God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac. What made God, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and ultimately the God of Jacob? It was that covenant promise that began back in Genesis 12 and is repeated again to Abraham, is repeated to Isaac, and has been already repeated to Jacob. And it's because of that promise that Jacob is now approaching God today. We can approach the throne of God because of the fulfillment of that promise, right? How do we get to God? John 14, verse 6, Jesus says, I am the way. No one comes to the Father but by me. The fulfillment of this promise, this covenant promise that was originally made to Abraham, is how we approach the throne of God today. Jacob approached God on the basis of that covenant. He reminded God of the command. God, he says, God, remember, you're the one that told me to go home. You're the one that told me to leave Laban and go back to where Esau is. Why, God, would you send me to my death? Surely, that's not what you have in mind. Why would you care for me for these 20 years and have me go home to be killed by my brother? He remembers the care that God had provided for him, that the blessings that he received, that in every hardship, every trial, every burden that he faced, God was there. God was providing for him. God was taking care of him. He reminded God of God's purpose for him and for those who would follow after him, those who would come after him, his descendants. See, that's one of the most beautiful parts of this prayer. Jacob wasn't just thinking about himself, but he was thinking about his descendants. He was thinking about his children and their children and on down the line. This promise that God had made to him, that he'd made to Abraham, he'd made to Isaac, and had made to Jacob, this promise would fail if Esau was to kill him. God made promises, or a promise to Jacob at Bethel, that he would do good for him, that he would multiply his descendants. And Jacob felt the need to remind God of those promises. And in so doing, I think, was trying to remind himself. Do you think that sometimes when we pray to God, you know, we don't have to say a word for God to know what we need. We don't have to say a word for God to know what we want. We don't have to say what God's will is or what God's desire is, but sometimes we need to, just so we can remind ourselves. And I believe that that's part of the purpose of this prayer of Jacob. We don't want to imitate Jacob when it comes to his fearfulness. We don't want to imitate Jacob when it comes to his scheming or his tendency to jump to conclusions. We don't want to imitate him in those ways, but we would do well to pray the way that he prayed here in verses 9 through 12.
Could I say something?
Yes, sir.
In this prayer, I see it, Jacob prayed. Okay, oh, Father Abraham, da-da-da-da. And that is an act of praise or worship, adoration, you know. And he gets on down there. Tries to remind God of that. And then on down right here, he says, I am unworthy. That's an act of contrition. Bow down to him, you know. And then down in the last part, verse 11, that where he asks for what he needs. He needs salvation from Esau. But then the last one there, in 12, he goes back to saying, thank you, Lord, praise you. And you've taught me to do this, and that's what I'm doing. And I think that's kind of cool. Start off with praise and end with praise.
That's right. And in this prayer, he claims the promises of God for himself. And he had every right to do that. He remembered the goodness of God, the good that God had done for him, the good that God was continuing to do for him, and he completely rested himself on God's character, his unchangeableness, I think that's a word, and his covenant. And so for us, there are going to be times, go ahead, Mark.
Okay, one I was thinking here too, you had been talking about God really knows the things that are on Jacob's heart. God already knows these things. And I'm wondering if one of the benefits of this prayer is for Jacob. Because, in my life, there have been times I've had issues, and when I verbalize those issues, I understand them better. And this is a real act of contrition, a humbling of oneself, and aligning oneself with the Lord, and verbalizing these things. It blesses you also in that it strengthens you. You know you've asked God this, and he is faithful. I wonder if Jacob didn't receive an awful lot out of just the fact that he did what he did. You understand what I'm trying to say?
I do, and that was sort of the way I was going to sum up this section, that no matter what circumstances we find ourselves in, no matter what fears we're facing, we can trust that God is going to be faithful to his promises. God doesn't change. His character, his nature remains the same, and his word doesn't change. His word stays the same. And so we can have complete confidence in the will of God and the word of God. And so no matter what, yes, it's hard, but we can face whatever comes our way fearless. Fearless, so long as we're on the Lord's side. When we try to rely on ourselves, when we try to do what we want to do, when we try to come up with a scheme to get around God's way, we're going to find ourselves in trouble, multiplying our trouble. But if we trust in God and remember his promises, remember his blessings, we're going to be okay. So you move into Casey.
This is a good format for us to pray as well. As we remind God, like we said earlier, we're really reminding ourselves. God remembers, but the combination of reminding God about his promises helps us remember his promises, and then as we humble ourselves before him, helps us to remember where all those things come from and our perspective and our relationship with him. I think it's a really good pattern to follow in our prayers.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Hopefully, if we do pattern our prayer life after this prayer of Jacob, we can come away from our prayers with more peace than he did. And you would think with the content of that prayer, with the power in that prayer, you would think it would have led him to overcome his fears. But that's not what we find. And so he decides, I'm going to pacify Esau. I'm going to try to do enough where he's not going to, it'd make him feel bad to harm me. I'm going to treat him so good, it's going to overwhelm any sense of evil or ill will that he has toward me. We've got 3 minutes left in class. We're not going to take the time this week to read 13 through 21, but what's the magnitude of the gift? It's huge. 580 valuable animals. And he divided them into separate herds and put different people over these herds and spaced them out, where it was almost like these gifts are coming in waves to Esau. So he'd just be completely overwhelmed. And then each one, Jacob commanded to say, they belong to your servant Jacob. They are sent as a gift to my lord Esau. And so as he uses those terms to refer to himself as a servant, refer to Esau as his lord, he's pretty well ignoring the prayer that he had just prayed. He's going back to this idea. He's ignoring that God had made him Lord, him master, him leader over his relatives. And that would include, certainly, Esau. Jacob had a further plan to protect himself. What if Esau's not impressed with this gift? Where's Jacob? He's not leading the way with the gift. He's hiding behind the last. Next week, we'll finish chapter 33 and go ahead and be reading chapter 34. We'll move in to there as we'll finish chapter 32 and go ahead and read chapter 33. How's that? Thank you for your comments and your attention.